you're doing great. Today we're joined by Stephanie and Jacqueline from Opera Mariposa, and we're super excited to have both of you on our show. Can you tell us a little about yourselves?
Well, my name is Jacqueline Coe. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm the founding artistic director of Opera Mariposa. I'm an operatic soprano, a model, and an ME/CFS advocate. I've been producing shows since I was 16, and I founded Opera Mariposa at age 20 with my best friend, Robin Hahn.
Yes, and Stephanie Coe here. My pronouns are she, her. I'm Jackie's sister and the general manager of Opera Mariposa. I'm also very active in disability and chronic illness advocacy, and I'm involved in the indie arts as a graphic designer, costume designer, publicist, and accessibility consultant.
Thank you for all the information. You two sound like very phenomenal individuals. And we want to learn a little bit about what is Opera Mariposa and how is it accessible, as well as how does it represent different types of disabilities?
Yeah, well, Opera Mariposa is an opera company that's dedicated to making opera more accessible for everyone and creating inclusive opportunities for emerging and underrepresented artists. So we have a particular focus on disability representation because we happen to be entirely led and run by folks who are disabled and or chronically ill.
Yeah, and in terms of being how we are accessible, accessibility has been built into Mariposa from the start, just because I am disabled. And one of the considerations has always been, how can we structure a production to make it doable for me as a disabled person?
Yeah, Stephanie here. Like, I think it was actually an organic process in many ways. Like, Jackie and I have ME, sometimes called ME/CFS, myalgic encephalomyelitis. It's this chronic neuroimmune disease. So, you know, we have to work with our access needs, but we didn't actually realize at first that we'd built an entire core team of disabled folks until someone pointed it out. I think basically we just created processes that were accessible to us, and that really seemed to resonate with folks. And we wound up building a team that shared those needs and similar values, I guess.
So my next question is, how did Opera Mariposa get started? And in other words, what's the background story of how Opera Mariposa was born or first thought about?
I mean, Mariposa started first as an idea that myself and my co-founder, Robin Hahn, would talk about over dinner and on late night car rides and stuff when we were teenagers. I'd produced a couple different shows by the time I was 17, and we knew we wanted to keep producing shows, and it just sort of seemed like a natural next step to found a company and, you know, to have a name to call ourselves. We didn't launch Mariposa until we were 20, and at that point, we were billing ourselves as a company by young artists for young artists.
And I have a very general next question, which is, how can opera in general be accessible to people?
Yeah, Stephanie here. I mean, I think accessible means different things to different people, right? Like, when we say we're making opera accessible, that's sort of a play on words. Like, we mean it in the sense of taking this classical art form with a really rich history and bringing it alive for today's audiences, like showing people how we view opera, which is, you know, it can be exciting and relatable and lots of fun, right? And then we mean doing the work to make it inclusive, like bringing down barriers and inviting more people in.
But honestly, I think both meanings of accessible are in the end the same thing, because all art, and that includes opera, is made for people to be able to see themselves in, and, you know, all people to be able to see themselves in. And for all people to be able to see themselves in it, they have to be able to partake in it, either as an artist or as an audience member.
Awesome. So this is related to Monica's question. And how do you find your artists for your team?
Yeah, Stephanie here. In the past, we've had a fairly traditional audition process. Like, we'll have a list of roles and positions to fill for project, then we'll hold open auditions and applications. And, you know, in some cases, we'll have a specific project or collaboration in mind involving a particular artist or artists. And in those cases, you know, we'll work with them to develop the project and bring it to life. I mean, these days, due to the pandemic and the fact that our core team is mostly immunocompromised and medically high risk, we're only really doing digital applications and remote collaboration methods, which, you know, has been a learning curve, obviously. But one of the exciting things is the lack of geographic limitations, right? Like, we recently finished the series where we partnered with an opera company in Toronto, and then we did this panel event featuring artists and arts workers from across Canada.
And related to Richard's question, if there's anyone in our audience who might be interested in joining Opera Mariposa, what do you look for as far as the auditions go?
I mean, it depends partly on the project. In general, though, casting is very much beyond any one individual person. We have to look at how a cast fits together. So if anyone is interested in applying, I say just go ahead and apply.
Opera Mariposa was basically built around the idea of accessibility. So I was wondering, in what ways is the performing arts in general accessible or not accessible?
Okay, Stephanie here. And I mean, that's an absolutely huge topic to explore. Like, I often frame accessibility as a continuum. Like, every venue, company, or work is somewhere along that continuum and hopefully, you know, working to make progress and move forward, right? Like, I think I've been fortunate in some ways because, you know, Opera Mariposa was created partially with my access needs in mind. But speaking in generalities, I'd say accessibility in the performing arts crosses a lot of different realms. Like, there's physical accessibility, which I think is what a lot of people think about first, right? Like, whether venues are accessible. And when I say that, I don't obviously just mean for wheelchairs. I mean for different body types, different heights, different, you know, mobility considerations, but also not just accessible in terms of can you get in the door, but can you have an alike experience? Like, I'm a wheelchair user, and, you know, before the pandemic, I would go to theater shows, but it's not uncommon to be relegated to the back, or you can get into the audience, but there's no way to get up on stage, right? And then financial accessibility is a big one, and that obviously disproportionately impacts, you know, folks with disabilities or chronic illnesses, but that's certainly not the only people it impacts, right? There's, for artists, there's training, traveling, you know, for audience members, ticket pricing. And I do see this from both sides, because like a lot of arts companies these days are very under-resourced as well, and are obviously navigating a particularly challenging period, you know, and then there can be like attitudinal barriers, like stereotypes, assumptions, biases about things like disability or race or body type. Temporal accessibility for me is, and for a lot of people, I think is one of the big ones, like, you know, the schedules that are required, the long hours, the degree of short notice sometimes, and then the aspect of safety, like psychological safety, physical safety. You know, I work with ActSafe, which is, you know, a educational body for, like, you know, safety in the performing arts. And then immunological safety, obviously, is an enormous one for accessibility right now, during the pandemic, in particular. Then there's accessibility in terms of the content. So that would be like captions, interpretation, audio description, alt text, you know, design choices. So this comes into things like sensory access as well. So like lighting, sound levels, all those things, because people have different access needs. And accessibility isn't only a disabled person thing either, right? Like, you know, people can have access needs if they're elders, children, you know. Yeah, so I'd say there's so much to get into. I could just go on for ages.
I think those are some really, really important points that you brought up, because like accessibility is so multifaceted and we need to be able to think about all these different areas and not just focus on the one thing, right? Now let's talk about some of the productions that Opera Mariposa has done. Can you talk about some of the highlights, some really good moments in your productions that you've done in the past?
I mean, I think every show has its highlights, and, you know, I'm both a performer and a producer, so, you know, there are a whole bunch of different moments in every show that stick out to me. Some absolute highlights, some moments of complete panic, but I'd say for me, the highlight is always just how it comes together, and there's a sort of magic that happens when you have a whole group of people on stage who are just there in the same moment and on the same wavelength. I'd say that one of my favorites was our production of Mozart's Così fan tutte. That show is a has such beautiful music and some really intricate ensembles, and so it was really magical having those come together.
Yeah, Stephanie here. Like, I have a lot of favorites too, so it's hard to pick. Like, if I had to pick a production that stands out, it's probably Verdi's In Ballo and Maschera, which is Italian for a masked ball. Like, it was this grand opera with this huge cast. We teamed up with another local company, also disability-led, called Heroic Opera to present it. And we featured performers from across 5 continents. And it stands out to me just because we had a chance to work with so many amazing artists and one of my favorite directors. And, you know, and I really love historical costumes too. Like, you know, I'm just really into the whole grand opera thing. So, you know, it was a really extravagant piece with like a masquerade ball and all that kind of thing. So yeah, like that's a great memory for me. I mean, other than the flood we had in the costume storage section, I mean, that stands out too, but in a different way.
Yeah, mid rehearsal.
Oh no. Honestly, that those sounds super exciting. Like with all the I haven't been to an opera, but I enjoy like the music on Spotify occasionally. So yeah, I really want to go see one someday. Awesome. So we've been talking about opera Mariposa for a while. So I was wondering, what does the name Opera Mariposa mean?
Well, Mariposa comes from the Spanish word for butterfly, and Jackie and Robin chose it because, you know, butterflies are a really meaningful symbol to them, because it, you know, it means like it's a symbol of beauty and inspiration. And, you know, Mariposa is about using the beauty of music to inspire positive change. And you know, then the butterfly's metamorphosis represents transformation, right? So like it was kind of about our commitment to creating a space where emerging artists and, you know, underrepresented artists can spread their wings.
I think that's really a really, really cool name. So previously you were talking about how accessibility, there's a lot of different considerations that go into making a production accessible for everyone. So I was wondering, what do your practices and rehearsals look like in terms of accommodating for everyone that's part of the opera and their various needs?
What I've always considered just to be the most important thing to accommodate everyone's needs is just to ask up front what their needs are, you know. And this, again, this goes beyond people who are, you know, meeting the needs of people who are disabled. Everyone might have specific needs. Some people have another job, or they're attending school full time. You know, they're only available for rehearsals at certain times of the day, for example.
Yeah, like Stephanie here, like I think it always depends on the like the artistic needs of the particular piece, and then on the people involved. I don't actually, like, you know, I don't think it's really possible to set things up, have things be entirely universally accessible, and it to just like go off on its own without, you know, without actually talking to the people involved. Like, one of the most consistent things we do probably has been scheduling for our whatever we're doing, rehearsals, performances, filming, you know, administrative stuff. It tends to be a lot more spread out. Like, that would be fewer hours per day or fewer days per week, you know, because this works a lot better for obviously folks with energy limiting illnesses like Jackie and me, but also, you know, folks with a lot of other types of chronic illnesses, disabled folks, or, you know, folks with other commitments, like Jackie said, you know, like jobs, school, family, and so on.
In regards to the rehearsals and the team, I was wondering, how does the funding and entering process work in Opera Mariposa? So kind of in other words, I know not everyone with disabilities can afford training. So how could Opera Mariposa assist with that?
I mean, Mariposa came into being partly as a platform for emerging artists and a way for them to gain stage experience. Because one of the realities is that a lot of the bigger companies want to see someone who who has roles on their resume already. One of the things that's very common that young artists do to get the experience necessary is they're called pay to sing programs, and where the young artists will basically it's like doing a course where you pay to do this course, and the end result is that is a production where you do get a role. But of course, some up and coming performers can struggle to get these opportunities, especially underrepresented and marginalized folks. And so part of the initial idea behind Mariposa was just to sort of give people a place, you know, to fill that gap.
Yeah, Stephanie here. Like, we're not a school or an academic program that offers formal training per se, but, you know, like in our past productions, we've had cast members who are, you know, established performers, multi-award winners who've like performed all over the world. And then they'll be sharing the stage with folks who are getting the experience of performing in their very first opera. So that's kind of what we see part of our role as in terms of, you know, helping with the, the training aspect, if you want to put it that way, and the development of emerging artists.
And in terms of the costumes that the performers wear for the productions, how do you accommodate people's different needs and styles of the costumes?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, we don't ask people if they're like disabled or not. Like, we don't like require disclosure. They're welcome to disclose if they wish to, but there are a lot of folks working professionally in opera who aren't like out professionally about that kind of thing. So what we just generally do is, in the sort of stage where you'd be getting measurements and stuff, we have spaces where people can share anything else they want to share. And we also check on things like, you know, allergies and other relevant access needs, I guess. So like, and after that, it's just, you know, it's very similar to any of the other logistical elements involved in costuming, you know, in terms of how costumes affect movement and how costumes affect, you know, the what things look like on stage. Like, it's just, you know, it's just problem solving, right? And, you know, singers have their own unique needs, or, you know, dancers have their own unique needs. It's same sort of idea, right? Like, some singers don't like to wear corsets that are too tight because it interferes with, you know, the way they breathe, and some singers don't want corsets too tight because it interferes with their insulin pump. It's the same idea, even if it's a different reason.
So I know you talked about the pandemic earlier. How has it affected Opera Mariposa as far as performances?
Well, the pandemic has had, you know, continues to have a huge impact, obviously, like on Opera Mariposa, on all our team members, because loud singing like opera is a high risk activity for producing aerosols, transmitting airborne illnesses. So like, when the pandemic hit, we were in the middle of planning our 8th annual benefit and awareness event, a charity event with a large cast of singers and dancers in person. And, you know, it was a difficult decision at the time, but we called a halt and we pivoted to doing an all digital charity event instead. And that's basically the direction we've continued to pursue. Like, I think a lot of arts companies these days are really navigating an evolving reality, and, you know, particularly with new variants emerging that are more contagious, more, you know, vaccine evasive. And in our case, most of our team members are already immunocompromised or medically high risk. So, you know, then Jackie and I, we have ME, and that's actually a disease that's triggered by viruses, including, it turns out, COVID-19. Like, researchers are now predicting 1 out of 10 people who get COVID, including mild cases, will probably wind up developing ME. So, you know, our priority is to do things in the safest way possible. So basically what we've been doing is we've been exploring tools for digital accessibility, remote collaborations. One of the things I've actually heard most often from folks who are already members of the disability community is that in some respects, the performing arts became more accessible to some of them during the pandemic, the initial stages, because, you know, things went online. It was possible to enjoy music and theater from home. And there were certain access measures that are more common online, like, you know, subtitles and captions would be one of them. So like, these days we're really working on developing that end of things.
And speaking of online events, we know that you hosted an online panel about disability, accessibility, and inclusion in opera. Can you tell us a little bit more about this past event, and will we see more events like this in the future?
Stephanie here. That event was called Making Opera Accessible, which we filmed in December 2020, which seems ages ago now. And at the time, we were in the first year of the pandemic in Canada. But also, you know, there's really this global reckoning with all sorts of systemic inequities. And it seemed like it was, well, past time to start having these types of conversations about disability and accessibility in the context of opera. So we invited some amazing artists and arts workers to join us digitally from across Canada. Landon Krentz, an amazing deaf opera creator from Saskatchewan, Ophira Kaloff, a disabled writer, performer, producer from Toronto, well, a bunch of amazing folks. And we were fortunate enough to have funding from Creative BC and the City of Vancouver. And the discussion was hosted by our co-founder, Robin Hahn. So folks can still catch the whole thing on our website or YouTube channel. And yeah, we'd absolutely love to have more conversations like this in the future. People have asked for that. And, you know, there's a lot to delve into.
On your website, it states that opera can be for everyone and that you work with both disabled and non-disabled artists to present compelling, critically acclaimed programming for diverse audiences. Would you be able to explain the process behind this a little bit?
Well, Stephanie here. I mean, basically what we mean when we say that is our goal is to create opera that welcomes more people in, right? Like we're disability led. We don't only work with artists who identify as disabled. Like I said, we don't require folks to disclose, you know, whether they're disabled or not. Like, we are very out, but our goal is essentially to create an environment where disability, chronic illness are naturalized as part of human diversity. So as an administrator, my idea of my priority is just to give all our artists what they need to do their best work, to be the most creative. And we've been very fortunate in terms of, you know, the amazing artists we've been able to work with. And, you know, and then it's everything they bring to it that makes each project, you know, special or compelling or memorable.
Yes, as far as I'm concerned, we're doing essentially the same thing as every other opera or theater company out there. We're working with a group of immensely talented people just to make the best show possible.
And I'm sure that, like, you guys are working together as sisters, you might run into some conflicting sibling opinions of that kind of sort. So how do you navigate working together as both coworkers and family members and the challenges that could possibly arise from that?
Well, Stephanie here. Opera Mariposa is a team effort that's just a lot bigger than Jackie and me. Like Robin Hahn, you know, co-founded the company too. We have a team of folks behind the scenes year round. And then with each project of production, we have artists, production team members, technical support staff, volunteers. So, you know, there can be a lot of diverse viewpoints, right? And you know, projects do encounter challenges. Like to me, that's kind of part of the creative process, right? And that's part of the process of working on any team. Like I wouldn't say we've encountered conflicts because we're siblings. I think if anything, it makes it easier in some ways because, you know, we have a more similar background, a more similar frame of reference. Yeah, like basically it's just the same way we navigate it with other production members.
So in one of your interviews with BC Disability, you discussed the industry's reliance on being able-bodied in order to use your body as an instrument for opera singing. So do you have any personal experiences of feeling this pressure, and does it negatively affect your performance?
I mean, I think my perspective is very much based around the fact that I was disabled when I've been disabled my entire career. So I think someone would have a very different experience becoming disabled after they are already a singer. But I wouldn't say that it's ever negatively affected a performance just because, you know, apart from anything else, when I'm on stage, I have so many things to be thinking about. I'm thinking about, you know, just the next word, the next movement, and I just don't have time to be thinking about other things. I'd say, though, that that pressure, because I went into this knowing that I am disabled and I am a singer, has been more external. I'm aware that, you know, maybe a director might if a director knowing that I'm disabled might then, they might then deem me, you know, too unreliable to be cast just on the basis of knowing that I am disabled. And it you know, in the past, I haven't always mentioned up front that I am disabled. And, you know, there is also this sort of fear in opera of being seen as a diva just but for asking for an accommodation that you need, asking for your accessibility needs to be met. So, you know, yeah, that has always been more the how that's affected me. Everyone, I think, has a very different experience with it depending on their lived experience. And in my case, I know that I am a singer, and being disabled isn't an issue.
Thank you so much for sharing that experience and your experiences with us. And we know that Opera Mariposa has, of course, done productions, and then we talked a little bit about the online panel. But if we look back at all of the other events that you guys have done, what are some other events that Opera Mariposa has hosted in the past?
Oh, well, we have done we're in our 10th year now, so we've done quite a few. There's a whole range of operas, you know, from the little one-act chamber pieces with only a couple cast members to the grand opera with big chorus, and, you know, from the Mozart comedies to the Verdi tragedies, and, you know.
Like, Stephanie here, we've also done a lot of concerts, community programming, like, you know, before the pandemic, going out to retirement residences, neighborhood festivals, you know, the library, you know, kind of connect with people that way and bring music out into the community, as well as panel events made for digital performances. Like our co-founder, Robin Hahn, is actually a YouTuber as well as a performer. And then, you know, Jackie's a recording artist as well. And then we have our annual benefit and awareness events, are one of the highlights. You know, those take place every May, which is the awareness month for chronic neuroimmune diseases like the one we have. And then every May we partner with a charity to raise funds and awareness for the chronic illness community.
Awesome. So, Jacqueline, you teamed up with pianist Karen Schmuka to celebrate the 10th anniversary of our first ever benefit and awareness show. What was that experience like for you?
Okay, so that was a really incredible experience. The show was called The Impossible Dream, and we did it in 2019. It was actually the last benefit and awareness show that we did live, because we were just about to start rehearsals for a 2020 benefit and awareness show when lockdown began. It does hold a very special place in my heart. It was the 10th anniversary of the first ever fundraiser that I did to support charities benefit and awareness show. In a lot of ways, it felt like a celebration of how far I'd come as an artist since I first started. You know, I sang some of the same pieces that I sang in my very first fundraiser, and it was really amazing to come back to that music 10 years on. There is a very big difference between a voice at 17 and a voice at 27, and Karen Schumke, the pianist that I worked with on the show, she is a fantastic collaborator, and it's really great when you're on stage to feel supported by the person or people that you're on stage with. It was pretty amazing.
Wow, that sounds absolutely incredible. And now we have a question specifically for Stephanie. So Stephanie, we know you are a designer. Can you tell us what kind of designing you do?
I've done a lot of costume design in a indie arts context, you know, for theater, opera, plays, short films. And I'm currently Opera Mariposa's head of costumes, as well as the other stuff I do. And I'm also a graphic designer. So that would be, you know, like posters, ads, show programs, websites, that kind of thing.
Great. I'm really interested in getting really interested in seeing Opera Mariposa show. Kind of want to check out live opera sometimes. So if someone wanted to check out some of the Opera Mariposa performances, how would they be able to access the tickets, and how much are they usually?
Well, I mean, at the moment, we're presenting our programming digitally for the broadest accessibility And folks can always find out what we're doing at operamariposa.com. Like historically, we've offered sliding scale pricing. So, you know, kind of between, I think, $15 to $28 or whatever-ish. But, you know, right now, a lot of it's actually free. Like, we know that a lot of people aren't in the position during the pandemic to... So, we have a series, for example, called Opera Treats, which features bite-sized performances kind of by some of our singers. And that's just up on YouTube for people to kind of play on demand. And we have a few new videos coming out as part of our current benefit and awareness event, which is running right now. And I encourage folks to check that out at benefit.operamariposa.com.
Well, I'll definitely be checking that out probably after this interview. Now, what would you say to someone who might be listening about learning to become more comfortable in their own skin to do performances?
I mean, I think becoming comfortable in your own skin as a performer is a very individual journey. And, you know, some days I am more comfortable in my skin than others still. But I found that just in general, you know, practice helps. But yeah, it's something that you continue working on. You know, when we made the pivot to digital performances, I had to get comfortable singing to a camera instead of to a live audience. And that's actually a very different experience. And so I had to get comfortable all over again. And I would say, though, the one thing that does sort of help is to have the people around you who you trust and who can help you, you know, be that teachers or friends or colleagues. You know, some days I'm just not feeling like I'm at my best in some capacity, and just having someone there who knows me as a performer, and they can say, I know you're not feeling well, I know maybe even you've sung better than this in the past, but this is still, you know, it's still a good performance. Just, it keeps me focused on the most important thing, and that is giving the audience a good performance, giving the audience a good experience, even if it's even if I'm, you know, feeling like it's maybe not the best work I've ever done.
I know that in opera, there's occasionally some characters that have some sort of disability. So do you think that characters about disabled persons should be also performed by disabled people? And why or why not?
Okay, Stephanie here. And there is a lot of disability representation in opera, you're right. There's actually been a database compiled, and opera is the genre that has the most disability representation of all the genres of music back from, like, I think 1600 to the modern day or something. But this is a complex topic, and I know it's one that evokes a lot of strong feelings in the disability community. I'll say I'm a big believer in the idea of nothing about us without us. And I'm always very excited to see authentic disability representation. At the same time, I realize there is some degree of nuance here, because I know many disabled and chronically ill artists are not out professionally, you know, for a lot of very good personal reasons. And you know, some folks don't necessarily want disability or want their personal medical history to be the focus of their artistic identity, or to be, you know, or they're not comfortable going over that stuff in promotional interviews, you know. And unlike race, for example, like disabled and non-disabled are demographics that folks can move between, right? Like the majority of the population ends up joining the disability community eventually. So, yeah, so there are shades of gray. What I'll say is just, I'd really like to see a lot more disabled artists being cast, whether or not those characters need to be disabled, right? Like at least 20% of adults in Canada are disabled. Well over half the population has at least one chronic illness. This is like a very basic fact of human diversity. And right now our stages, our screens, our media in general doesn't represent that. And that shapes the way people think about disability, right? Like I remember Opera Mariposa worked with a phenomenal artist who had a mobility disability. And one of our audience members, after seeing the show, actually asked us why the director chose to have that character portrayed with a limp, like what the symbolism was behind the artistic choice, because people are so unused to disabled artists being cast or visibly disabled artists being cast that it's genuinely more plausible to assume someone on stage is pretending to be disabled than to realize you're seeing a real disabled person. You know, and given how much of our population is disabled, I think that's very telling.
And I think as an artist that there can be something very empowering as a disabled person to be able to play aspects of your own lived experience on stage, you know, even if it's the negative parts.
I think those are some really good points. Like, media and art, it should be representative of our diverse population. And you've talked about how you have ME, which is myalgic encephalomyelitis. And how is this usually diagnosed? And why do you think it's rarely talked about?
Okay, well, myalgic encephalomyelitis is a diagnosis of exclusion. So if you meet the criteria and test negative for other potential diagnoses that would explain the constellation of symptoms and the distinctive patient history, that's how it's usually diagnosed. It's a process that can and usually does take many years. There are some specific things to watch out for, and science has shown that the bodies of people with ME function really differently, but at this point, there isn't an easy diagnostic test readily available.
Stephanie here, and in terms of it not being talked about much, like, obviously this isn't an issue that's exclusive to ME. There are a number of medical conditions, you know, and illnesses that historically, you know, and presently are, you know, are sorely in need of more awareness. Like, ME in particular is a serious case because it's such a severe illness, and it's also very common. Like, it affects an estimated 70 to 24 million people, many more times than, say, multiple sclerosis would be an example many people have heard of. And they also estimate that about 90% of ME people with ME don't get diagnosed. And one of the reasons is because it's seldom taught in medical schools. And again, this is not the only illness that historically, you know, hasn't been included in the curriculum or has been covered very briefly, or sometimes folks, unfortunately, like medical folks in training don't necessarily receive the most up-to-date information. I think one aspect of it is it's taken a while, certainly for the scientific community to advance, like, you know, just for society to advance our understanding of it, because it affects a lot of different body systems in a lot of different ways. It can look different in different people. And historically, it has been under-researched, underfunded. I think that's held things back. It can affect people of all genders and all ages, but it disproportionately affects women, by which I mean, you know, folks assigned female at birth. And that has been an issue in the past too. There have been, you know, outbreaks where it affected women more disproportionately, and it was just attributed to mass hysteria, you know, oh, hysterical women, that kind of thing. So, you know, there've been a lot of elements, scientific, sociological, financial, but that is slowly changing, right? Like, I know most doctors polled still say they don't feel confident in diagnosing ME, and a disproportionate number of them say they're not completely sure if it's a real illness, even though, you know, obviously science, you know, we know that it is, but some places, for example, now are offering continuing education credits to learn about ME and learn up-to-date information. And, you know, as these things get put in place on the educational level, on the policymaking level, on the healthcare level, then that flows through in terms of, you know, in terms of patients being able to access care, being able to access benefits, being and broader awareness in the community and people getting the support they need. So you know, we're making progress. There's just still a really long way to go.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Thanks so much for explaining a lot about ME to us. I also wasn't aware that there were so many people that potentially have this disability. And I'm happy to hear that it's slowly getting better. But yeah, for sure, we definitely need to raise more awareness about this disease so that it can do a lot better in diagnosing and helping and supporting people with it. So back to Opera Mariposa. So I know last year you held a benefit and awareness event to raise funds and awareness for chronic neuroimmune diseases. And people who entered could have won over $3,500 in prizes in support of the ME-FM Society of BC. What were some of those prizes, and could you please tell us more about this important cause?
Yeah, so this year we're doing our 10th annual event for the benefit of a 10th annual benefit and awareness event. Once again, it's for the ME-FM Society of BC, and it's running throughout the month of May. So until June 1st, online at benefit.operamariposa.com. We actually have a whole lineup of things, including, you know, new videos featuring Jackie and Robin, like shopping a shop to give event where people can buy things and the proceeds support the charity, an artwork showcase series where we're teaming up with the Toronto artist and ME advocate Christina Baltice, and then a prize giveaway. And again, this year we've got over $3,500 in prizes, and it includes all sorts of things like gift baskets, gift cards to places like Starbucks, Long and McQuaid, Kamwai Dim Sum, a fantastic local business based in Chinatown. We have our original artwork, designer jewelry and accessories, and then all sorts of like pandemic safe activities too. Like we have membership to the UBC Botanical Garden, a digital visit with like a party entertainer playing like a fairy tale princess from Ever After Character Company, and then a singing e-telegram, which is something Mariposa offers, where you get this like custom video performance from one of our singers. And so, yeah, there's all kinds of things. And 100% of the proceeds do support the ME-FM Society of BC, which is this terrific local charity that works to support and advocate for people living with ME and fibromyalgia, which is another chronic neuroimmune disease that where the patient population has sort of overlapping symptoms and needs, though it is a distinct illness of its own. So basically, all this is to help the growing number of people and families affected by these illnesses in our community. And thanks to some sponsors this year, actually, every cent we raise up to our fundraising goal is being tripled by matching donations. So, you know, like if someone gives $10, it becomes $30. If someone gives $100, it becomes $300. So, yeah, we really hope folks will check it out and definitely enter the prize draw at benefit.operamariposa.com.
For our next question, we want to kind of know, what do you think are the key factors or the key players that make theater accessible to people?
I mean, at the moment, I think the way accessibility has been happening in theater is that it's happening when the artists and audience members ask productions to meet their access needs. And I think ideally what would be happening is that accessibility is considered in a production from the outset. So, you know, right now it's happening from the bottom up and it needs to be happening from the top down.
Yes. Stephanie here. And I would echo this, that in many cases still, a significant portion of accessibility is reactive rather than proactive. And to me, that's one of the reasons it's so important to have better representation, including disability representation at every level. Like every level is key, because I think we really need all these different perspectives to have the kind of collective imagination to come up with projects and processes that welcome a diversity of people. Like some of the most exciting work right now in theater is being led from a grassroots level by deaf, mad, and disabled creators, BIPOC creators, queer creators. You know, it's folks who have in many cases previously encountered barriers in normative spaces and have started to really reimagine what theater can be and, you know, who's kind of leading this.
Are there any upcoming performances or events that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, we'd really love people to check out our 10th annual benefit and awareness event. It's our slogan is all month on all online and all for charity. So yeah, you can find that at benefit.operamariposa.com. You can also always find what we're up to at operamariposa.com and sign up for our e-newsletter to always get the latest updates. And connect with us on social media at Opera Mariposa.
And is there anything you would like to say to our listeners?
you know, this is being recorded in honor of Global Accessibility Awareness Day, of course. So I guess I'd like to thank people for joining us, right? Like, you know, this is a day that's all about raising awareness and bridging gaps, and particularly with a focus on digital access and inclusion. So, you know, we're really thrilled that people are taking the time to share the day with us and take part in the conversation from, you know, wherever they are. So thank you.
And last but not least, what does accessibility mean to you?
I think to me, accessibility means being able to voice your access needs without fear and with the knowledge that they will be recognized and taken into consideration.
Stephanie here. To me, accessibility is the how-to part of inclusion. Like, it's the part that involves finding ways to proactively bring down barriers and create spaces and processes that welcome and foster human diversity.
Marco was an animator and a visual effects artist. He worked long shifts, sometimes up to 14 hours a day. When he gets home from nitpicking over keyframes,